Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And that debt is fraud, as you know. And it's now or never. And if you're going to make an appeal to heaven, by all means, please do so, because we need divine intervention, and we need to help touch or prick the minds of those who are in service of us. They probably don't realize how little they know. We live in a time when people are deniers that they know so little, because everybody feels like they know too much. I mean, there's a stage in life when a child reaches the point of age where they are convinced that they know everything, and they tell their parents, "No, you don't know anything." I believe for several generations, we have failed to get out of that mode, because I do know that as you get older, the natural trend is you start realizing how little you really knew. Even though your mind was able to receive basic information of lots of stuff, you had opinions on all of that, sadly, you knew very little. And so these are times that, you know, actually, just however they said it back then, I believe it was, "These are times to try men's souls." I think that was Thomas Paine. These are times that are trying our souls. And we have some challenges, there's no doubt. I mean, we can't ignore the problem that, one, we're illiterate regarding the Constitution and our governance and this form of government that we have. We need to kind of understand, we need to figure out, well, actually not. Let me back up. I believe that there are some very unique things that I've extrapolated, and I challenge anybody to tell me otherwise. When you look at the Republican form of government that was created out of that U.S. Constitution, they created a representative government that represented the sovereigns, both the people and the government that they made sovereign over them for their state, to create a sovereign state. Now, they didn't think beyond the state, but they knew, why did they have to create counties? Because counties did the bulk of the work. Even Thomas Jefferson referred to the local government as the most powerful government, because I forget when he was asked, but it was after the Constitution had been written, and I'm not sure if he was the vice president, if he was the secretary of state, if he was out of government for a moment, or whether he was the president of the United States. He served in a lot of roles after that Constitution. And I don't know when he said this, but what's important is this is what he said, that we have the political power of this republic is distributive in form. In other words, the powers aren't made, you know, all the powers do not reside in D.C. Very little power resides in D.C. And all of the rest of the political power is allowed to flow outward to the states and to the people locally. And Thomas Jefferson said that you will find the residual mass of power to be with the people locally. This was because they were creating constitutions that were limited in kind, that they only delegated specific powers to government, where the people had the power to do whatever they wanted to do for themselves. And this is where, at that point in time, behavior, the behavior of people, I mean, they had standard laws like no prostitution, those types of things at the local level. Prostitution wasn't enforced by the state. It was enforced by the local government. In other words, I believe that's one of the reasons why you look at the state government. There was no delegation of power over crime. Now, that's because everything was done locally by the churches and so forth, and maybe they just had their own common law courts. That's probably what they did have, is common law courts. And so when we look at this concept of the county having, you know, the laws, but the people being governed by the churches, in other words, everybody behaved well. They didn't need to have laws. Can you fathom that? That there wasn't really a law that said you can't copy something from somebody else and publish it as your own. That would be plagiarism. I don't believe, even though plagiarism existed, I don't think that many of the states and counties and so forth had laws on plagiarism. It was really more of a moral law. How dare you? I mean, nobody wanted to bear the shame of being caught. Now, it doesn't mean the people didn't do it, possibly, but the point is the majority of the people behaved because they were good. They had these morals, and the mores, in other words, that moral attitude of our culture was very good because they were righteous people. Now, that didn't mean government was managing everything. It didn't. It managed very little. And so you were free to pile up as much firewood as you wanted. You could have a 10-year supply of firewood if you wanted. You could have all the guns, the black powder, and all of that, as much as you wanted. Most people were being very industrious and very thrifty, and they only had what they needed. Now, you know, there was this concept of, okay, we need to store up enough to get through the winter, because they didn't have these huge warehouses to basically put a lifetime supply of firewood. They lived based on their needs. And the problem with, you know, living like that is if all of a sudden a drought or some, you know, God forbid, some bad turn of weather or what have you that really had a bad effect, then you would be without. And those were the risks. As we talked with Tammy, you know, we always have to mitigate risk, but 9 times out of 10, people today don't do that. People today just think that, you know, it's going to be covered. And we've gotten to a point where the federal government steps in and actually covers things. And they don't have the authority to do that, folks. They don't have the authority. In other words, the rest of us are paying taxes to basically cover everybody from the problems, the sins, and so forth. And that's wrong. Well, why not? I mean, you didn't need that money. Anyway, that's the logic of these people. Anyway, in your appeal to heaven, we need divine inspiration and intervention. So by all means, if you're going to create a group prayer, let me know. Moving on, as you know, your campaign needs to begin today. I keep saying this, and the groups that I'm working with, I keep saying this. You know, you need to start your campaign. In other words, you need to start taking petitions. You may not have a lot of signatures. By the way, how many signatures can you, how many times can you actually go and obtain signatures on a petition? You have a petition, and you know it's not going to be redressed. And they're going to be, you know, fumbling with it. They're not going to do anything. That means that you can submit that petition with just your handwriting, with your signature, and say, I am petitioning you, and I'm going to be getting signatures. And I'm going to tell you how many signatures I get as I keep informing you that the people are getting informed and they're getting upset. And eventually you'll start showing up with other people. Eventually you'll start showing up with a lot of people. And as you do that, they're going to get the message that more and more people are actually on board with this. And when you start telling them, well, we're in the thousands now, even though they only see 20 or 30, that doesn't mean you don't have 1,000 people that know and are interested on this. You got to remember, it takes a lot for a person to take their time out of, you know, whatever the important things in their lives, feeding the family, what have you, and go and spend time with government. It's very small. I mean, you're lucky if you could even get 10%, unless it was really well organized and convenient for everybody, like on a Saturday or something. But anywho, the point is this, is that you can start your campaign now. And as people see how you're leading in the charge for liberty for all, you will be viewed as a very great candidate to lead in the capacity of whatever, starting off at the county, going up to the state legislature. You could become the shoe-in favorite for the governor. Don't think this won't happen, because there is that much illiteracy, there's that many problems, and those people, you're one of them, you get this. So if you're out there leading people, you become the odds-on favorite. Now, I'm hoping that there's so many people listening to this show that, because we actually have good following. We have, you know, good ratings on streaming. So I know that you're listening, and I hope that there's so many people in your state that are also listening, that as the, you know, the many of you start stepping up, you start stumbling across each other, and you start realizing, wow, there's a few people like me here that we should be able to work together. You need to work together, because if you're working together, you're becoming more efficient and effective. A good word for it is being efficacious. And so we want you to be efficacious, because when you're efficacious, you will be successful. And so we're hoping and we're prodding you to say, get out there, start educating, start, you know, and as a matter of fact, we have all the petitions you can get started with, just to get started. We have not 21, we've probably got about 15, 16, but we have other petitions that are in the wings, a couple petitions that you can use to basically defend yourself against corporations or defend yourselves against tyrants and those types of things. Most of these are just, I don't want to say administrative, but most of these go after these obvious, you know, the UN, the invasion, you know, usurp powers and so forth. So go read the petition, and I think you're going to find that there is this irrefutable argument that this particular item that we're petitioning on is unconstitutional. And it's not a matter of whether they could imply or, you know, well, the world came to us and they said, we need to make a treaty with you to do, you know, to join the UN, that we needed to be in the UN. It doesn't matter if the world needs us to be in the UN. The Constitution doesn't allow you to be in the UN. We have to amend the Constitution to say, yeah, go ahead, subjugate us to a foreign entity. When they went in the, this is what, so when you look at, and I'm hoping some of the state nationalists are listening right now, and the General Assemblists and Adavon Rich's crowds and so forth. When you look at going down that path of becoming a state nationalist, or when you look down that path of whatever it is, these corporations that are evil and all that stuff, go read that second petition, petition two. That is the petition that claims that the federal government cannot adjoin us in a treaty to any foreign entity and subjugate us. Do you understand that? We cannot be subjugated. to the federal government. The federal government is a service entity to serve the states. That is the hard relationship that that creature, that federal government, that creation of the states has. That is the relationship they are to serve. If they create this piece of paper that says they are now the almighty poobah of the United States, and that all the states are now their subjects, without the states amending the Constitution, my friends, that paper is worthless. I mean, you could use it in the restroom, you know, to clean yourself, but that's about the only good thing that that paper can do. That paper has, the writing on that paper has no validity. It is not legitimate. It is strictly a facade. It is a pipe dream. It is something that has no veracity. So, when we're looking at government and we're looking at these people and they say, well, they created these corporations and they created the Bar Association and they're doing all these things. Yeah. What is out of all of those things, which of those things are legitimate? They had the authority to do. There you go. They never had the authority. They keep on doing it and they're building upon it and everybody is stoking the fire and going, yeah, let's do this. And we're all on board. And even though people come to you and say, you have become a willing participant of that, you can't. You can't be a willing participant of fraud. The fraud is just being perpetrated upon you. Even if you pay your income tax because you're just trying to be a dutiful citizen and you don't know any better, that doesn't mean that you are, you know, their property. You aren't their property. There's no legitimacy. There's no piece of paper that has any legitimacy because they have no authority to do it. And this is what just, I want to yell at people. And I want to say, are you that stupid? Where did they get the authority? Prove to me they have the authority to do that before we even have this conversation. Go cite the case. And so what we're going to do today is we're going to get back to what I was talking about of what we need to do with the counties. But you've heard me talking with Tammy, and I sent out a document. I'm going to go through the document today with you because I really think that this is so important. I want you to be waiting with bated breath to say, "When GR, please let us know when you send out the truth about the 17th Amendment." Because there is no boogeyman in the 17th Amendment. Now, this isn't written like, you know, a little story or an instructions or anything else. What we have, sorry, I had to take a drink. What we have, and as a matter of fact, you notice I don't have a frog today. Watch, it's going to show up any minute now. So what we have is kind of a delineation. And so it starts off, obviously, the title, The Truth About the 17th Amendment. The next line basically says the state's suffrage in the Senate is not guaranteed in Article 1 in the Constitution. Okay? This is what is guaranteed, or this is what is stated, I'm paraphrasing, of what you'll find in Article 1. And it basically changes between the sections and so forth, so I'm not going to delineate what sections they are. But the allocation of senators per state is 2. In other words, the Constitution in Article 1 lays out that each state shall have 2 senators and that they will be chosen by the state legislature. That's in Article 1. Now, we know that the 17th Amendment changed that chosen by the state legislature. But it didn't change that there were going to be 2. And it didn't change that the voting power of each would be 1-1. In other words, each senator had its own vote. So that, you know, they could actually have, they didn't need quorum. They both couldn't vote to be one. They could actually vote. And it allowed them to basically think, well, I think they meant this, or I think they meant that. You got to remember, and I'm going to pause right here. and I made, and so what I'm going to do is make notes on this. So you, right here, this idea of the voting power for each senator, there was this proxy, and so the proxy created ambiguity due to the delays. So ambiguity, and so the reason why each of them had one vote is because maybe one senator left the legislature 2 years ago and thought that they had a better read on what they should be doing, what they wanted, and the other senator left 5 years ago. They're coming up for re-election, and they're sticking to what they were told. You got to remember that this is a non-real-time governing, you know, function and body, because there's this abyss. When you look at the senators for Maine who may go to D.C. and stay in D.C. for all 6 years, never going home. They even mentioned this in the ratification debates, that these guys would, you know, become islands and they would just start acting on their own. Yes, but it was clearly pointed out that the state legislature, if they felt that they weren't doing their duty in giving them their suffrage, they could replace them. Oh, okay. Well, that was why they appointed them. So now we know that that's changed, and so that accountability has changed somewhat. Because regarding the suffrage in this proxy, they're actually held to doing exactly what the... You see, the reason that it never came down to you had decisiveness. In other words, the state decisively told me to vote. Because if the state decisively told them to vote a certain way, and the legislature, because this is in the ratification base, if the legislature feels that they didn't give them their vote, they could remove them. But with the 17th Amendment, it took away the state legislature's way to remove them regarding Article 1. Ah, but not regarding the 14th Amendment and Article 5. So we're going to dive into that. So that's the very first part of the constitutional mentioning and or covering the Senate. The next one is down a little more, and the division of the Senate will be into three classes to ensure continuity due to the administrative matters that the Senate had to manage and maintain. They were managing treaties and so forth, and they didn't want to see a complete replacement of the entire Senate, where the House of Representatives, was the volatility of that was not that important. It was okay to completely plunge out and flush the House of Representatives and bring all new people in. But the Senate, they recognized they couldn't do that, or they thought that would be ill-advised due to the nature and the matters that they were having to deal with for the states. Okay, so the next thing is how the state would handle vacancies if a Senate seat became open during their session. And that, too, was changed by the 17th Amendment. And so, okay, we now know that the state legislature does not change them. It would go to the governor if the legislature empowered them, or it would go to, and that state, that Senate seat would remain vacant until the next election. Now, the next thing that is in Article 1 is the eligibility standards for the term in office. How many years a citizen and how many years old do you have to be? Okay, so it laid out these standards for senators, different than representatives and different for electors. The next thing in Article 1 is the leader of the Senate would be the vice president, who would only vote in a matter to break a tie. However, the Senate would be able to choose their leaders and officers, and they would call themselves, for in the absence of the vice president, a president pro tempore. And so that president pro tempore was Schumer. It was, who's that idiot that starts with an M? I can see his name. I see his face, but I can't see his name. But you know what I'm talking about. This is basically a party. Whoever the party controlling party is becomes the present pro tempore, and they anyway, we'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Mitch McConnell. So I get stammering on, who was that guy? Mitch McConnell. I'm sorry. I just have this blackout when I try to think of a name, and I just get, you know, it's like you get frozen solid in time, and you can't think, and I just, so I clumsily went into the break. Forgive me. So they have the ability, the Senate has the ability to select a president pro tem, so they will have a leader when the vice president is doing their duties and not available. And they will also have other leaders and ethics or what have you. So, I mean, and bottom line, I think that, you know, people create positions just to make sure everybody feels like they're included. You know, I mean, have you ever seen that? It's just like, everybody has a job and a responsibility so that they feel important. And that is so politically correct. It just, it's kind of like platforms. Everybody's got to get their own little platitude in that thing. Oh, yeah, that one's mine. That one right there, that's mine. Anyway. All right, so the other thing, they have three more things. The other thing is that the Senate has the responsibility of trying the president or vice president in an impeachment case. In other words, the House has the responsibility of determining whether he needs to be impeached, and the Senate tries that. And while they're in the impeachment, going into impeachment, each senator is again required to take another oath, okay? And then they have both the House and the Senate has the power, they have exclusive power to maintain their own rules and manage the conduct of their members. That right there was changed. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment changed that. They no longer have the exclusive use. If a senator violates the Constitution in their actions, they are legally obligated by the supreme law of the land to remove them. They don't get a chance to say, we're going to forgive you. I want you to understand, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is not a degree type of problem. One strike, two strike, three strikes, you're out. No. You do it, you're gone. It's a zero tolerance law. Now, I'm okay if you provide a first and final, because we're in a time right now where I think first and finals are appropriate for the next, you know, once this reality starts to bake in, I think the first and final is, you know, a very temporary point in time to say, okay, we get it, you didn't know, but you better hit the books because we're holding you accountable moving forward. You got one chance. You had your chance. You do it again. So, in other words, if you don't know, you better be asking, how is this constitutional? Show to me how we have the authority to do this. Not some excuse that we can imply that we can do this. You need to now, every person in office needs, even the judges, you need to show me how this arises under this Constitution where we have jurisdiction, because a judge like that should be removed. If they take and hear a case that is not something that arose under that Constitution, again, I think there's a short period of time where you get a first and final. Because people really won't know maybe what's hitting them. They may not even know it's happened because they're just reclusive. And so that's when the state legislature will go to the judge, send a correspondence to the judge. We understand that you may not have seen this memo, but so we're going to graciously give you a first and final. If you hear another case, and that case right there needs to be thrown out, if you hear another case that doesn't arise under this Constitution, this is all for federal judges. If that case you're letting in and you're hearing a case and it does not arise under the Constitution, it's over labor dispute, it's over housing, it's over, you know, energy policies, whatever, that those cases shouldn't, state land, is calling it federal land, unconstitutional federal land. Oh, well, it's federal land. No, actually, you got to prove to me that's federal land. And if it is federal land, then you do have the jurisdiction. But it has to be an enumerated land identified in the Constitution. And you're not going to find forests. You're not going to find BLM. You're not going to find Indian reservations in the Constitution, which means you have no jurisdiction. Sorry, Judge. You know, it doesn't look like you have much to do today. Maybe you could go home and plant a garden. Because, folks, if you realize how little they have, they're taking on more and more just so they can make sure that they're busy in making money and they can actually give jobs to other judges because we want to make them busy too. This is why we want everything under the sun to come to us so we can make money on this. Talk about self-serving evil, right? Okay, so again, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment literally changed the constitutional or the ability for the chambers and even the justices to kind of, you know, manage their behavior, their ethics, and so forth. If it comes to the violation of the Constitution, they have failed to support it. They have failed to do what was necessary in supporting the Constitution, not an agenda, then they're gone, period. Okay, so that's the language in Article 1. And believe it or not, as I said earlier, that there's actually language in the Constitution in Article 2 that actually discusses the roles and responsibilities of a senator. So this, not House of Representatives. The House of Representatives really isn't mentioned in Article 2 except for they would, you know, they will they will commence the impeachment. But number one, the Senate will participate in directing the time, place, and manner with the as a part of the state legislature. So the entire state legislature, including the House, but the entire state legislature has this responsibility of participating in directing the time, place, and manner of choosing electors who are to be chosen to choose the president and vice president separately. In other words, the Constitution is very clear on how that's happening, how that can be done. Even though they've created laws and they're violating it, remember I told you that if it's not in Article 1, Section 8, they can't make a law about it. But if they want to change the Electoral College Clause, then they have to amend the Constitution. And it was clear that the intent, even, and actually it was in the ratification debates as well, the people were to choose their electors. The people. The people chose the electors, not the president. So this concept of choosing the president and having a popular vote that we've been doing for decades and decades and decades is unconstitutional. You want to change it, you have to amend the Constitution because it is not changeable. It is a standard. It is a role. It is a responsibility. You don't just, you know, why doesn't the president just say, you know what? I have these responsibilities, and I'm not going to do them this way anymore. I'm instead of going to the Senate to appoint Supreme Court justices, I'm just going to seat them. I'm just going to go ahead and have them sworn in because they don't follow the process of how I'm chosen. So why should I follow the process of how I choose and seat my ambassadors and my judges and my cabinet? Right? I mean, do we all get to cherry pick what we don't want to do so that we have an advantage? Believe it or not, folks, the parties are the ones with the blood on their hands regarding this, because and the state legislatures are the ones that actually unconstitutionally allow the parties to control our political system. The state legislatures are the ones who created the laws to allow the party to control our political system and the outcome of the presidency and the outcome of politics. Do you understand what I'm saying? In other words, they're benefiting and maintaining their relevance, because prior to this, parties would come and go. Parties would instantly become extinct because they would no longer have this life anymore. There was a better party. A better party came along, and they said, you know what, this isn't good. We can't get anywhere if we keep on having these parties come and go. So let's create two parties that will be permanent. Good and evil, you know, diametrically opposing, whatever. Anyway, so the advice of the Senate, so again, back to the senators in Article 2, the Senate shall provide advice and consent to making treaties to the president. In other words, it will require two-thirds of the senators to concur on a treaty with whatever treaty the president came. Now, remember that that treaty has to be within the enumerated powers. It can't make a treaty if, over commerce, yeah, over war, yeah, you know, over peace or ending war, yeah, to some degree. But they cannot adjoin and actually participate in lawmaking for others or basically submitting laws from others to us. That can't happen. They don't have that level of interplay. This union was to be the superior union for the world. This constitution was God's plan of global governance, that nations would come into this union and enjoy liberty. Because when you really think about it, other than the fact that we had this thing called the Civil War, and the reason we had the Civil War is because they didn't abide by the Constitution. They didn't, neither the South nor the North, they all basically started hacking at it from the Missouri Compromise and the terrible tariffs and so forth. They were each attacking each other. And that right there basically, I think, finalized any form of hostility that could ever come up in America again between the states. It was over. And believe it or not, I mean, we're still suffering today because of racism and those types of things because of what they did. But that being said, there is no reason why there would ever be warfare within the states anymore, unless the federal government is manipulating us and causing these things to happen, which they are. Get them back into compliance. We would be a very happy and productive union. Nations would come into the fold. It would take a long time. But if nations want to enjoy liberty, or if they want to actually see their lifestyles and their homes and their traditions scourged, you know, to be tossed to and fro by from anarchy to despotism, because that's what they have, then that's their choice. We cannot inflict upon them a better form of government. But there has to be a clear and concise way of determining what the people want. We do have to recognize that the people institute government. That if the people feel in China, that's right, you hear me say this, if the people in China feel it is time to abolish that government and what they're doing to them, and they basically, they plea And, you know, they say, hey, hold on here, China, you know, to the world. They're playing to the world. So we kind of create this little commission to step in and do this mass survey to basically, yes, the people really want to have an election. China, you need to, sorry, your people don't like anymore. And we don't need to necessarily see a revolt. But maybe, you know, if you want to say, okay, what do we need to do? But you can't, even though a state and a nation is sovereign, if the people themselves do not want that sovereignty that has assumed these powers, you got to remember that the Communist Revolution of China was done by a minority to inflict slavery upon the many. And the many are still locked in slavery. The Falun Dong are all political prisoners. That millions of Falun Dong. And so we can't just stand idly by and let those types of things happen when the voice of the people is not being heard. It's only being suppressed. So if the fact is that they do communicate, however, you know, that they, you know, publish and promulgate that we want to have an open and fair election and we need to do this, then I believe, because this goes down to the court of opinion, not the National Court of America or the National Court of the UN. This goes down to the fundamental humanity, laws of nations, not the UN, laws of nations, to where when a people want to cast off their government, and they want to institute a different government, should they go through the revolution? Because in today's, the way we see things today, China would annihilate itself. In other words, they would kill so many people if the people actually tried to. And what would end up happening is the people would just be, they'd be castigated. They'd be subjugated. They would be forced into, and the leaders would be thrown into gulags or prisons, what have you. You see my point? Anyway, let me get back to what's the truth about the 17th. Sorry for going there. So they also have, the Senate also has the responsibility of providing advice and consent to the president in his appointing of ambassadors, ministers, consuls, judges, and basically officers of the United States executive, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, so forth, the Secretary of War. Okay, so what did the Constitution, the 17th Amendment, change in the Constitution? In other words, the language of the 17th Amendment only did certain changes. It didn't change all of these things we just listed. When it comes to senators, this is everything in Article 1 and 2. This is everything that they have. In Article 3, they have a shared responsibility of controlling and regulating the court. That is Congress's job, to control and regulate the court. Okay? And there's no change to it that allows the court to do that. So Congress is sleeping at the wheel. They're failing to do what they're supposed to do. So the language of the 17th Amendment is basically this. And this is what it changed. The Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators, which is basically the same language, elected by the people thereof, and then the rest of it is language that didn't change, for 6 years, and each senator shall have one vote. The electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch. Okay, so the electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislatures. I'm going to flag this because why is this in the 17th Amendment? Did the person who write this not understand that that had nothing to do with the Senate and the appointment of the Senate or anything? That has everything to do with the presidential electors. And for some reason, somebody thought that it was important to include, to maintain the same language. In other words, they weren't going to touch the electors. What? So this shows me that whoever wrote the 17th Amendment didn't understand what they were doing. That line should not even have been there. And I think, because I see most people refer to the voters as electors, The voters are the electorate. You don't call the voters an elector. You call them the electorate. They're the voters, right? An elector is actually a very specific person in our government. In other words, we changed how this definition is, and it's gotten so muddy that everybody believes that they're individual electors, and you're not. You're the electorate. You are the people at large who vote. Electors in America are the very few people who were chosen by the electorate to choose their president. That's what an elector is. And so I see this all the time. I see this in constitutions. As a matter of fact, I noticed it in the Iowa Constitution. They were referring to electors. And actually, they were speaking of those people that were the voters. They wanted to use elector because it sounded nice. It was in the Constitution. And they didn't even understand that. I can't believe that they understood that, because to me, an elector under this Constitution has very significant meaning, and it is different than a person who votes, a voter or an electorate. You know, you're a member of the electing body. That's why we just call them voters, the elector. Anyway, so the next paragraph is what changes the replacement, okay? So they've changed the process that they'd be elected by the people. Now, when vacancies happen in the representation of any state in the Senate, this is the change. The executive authority of each state shall issue writs of election for such vacancies, provided that the legislature may empower the executive thereof to make temporary appointments until the people fill their vacancies. So, in other words, when you look at the process, the state legislature could empower the governor to basically appoint a replacement, or the legislature could actually make it so that that seat sits vacant until the election time, so that they don't give an advantage to somebody. And if I was directing the state legislatures, I would not allow the governor to appoint. I would make sure that whoever got that seat was thoroughly vetted through an election process. Because why? These people are supposedly the proxy for the Senate. Where did that come from? We'll get into that. Okay, the amendment shall not be construed as to affect the election or term of any senator chosen before it becomes valid as part of the Constitution. So in other words, this constitutional amendment is out there lingering. It was submitted in 1913, and it was out there, and in 1814, there was a Senate election, and those senators, while this is still lingering, basically were chosen by the legislature so that they were then occupying those seats. It wouldn't change. It wouldn't basically go everybody loses their seat. But when the senator's term comes up after this is ratified, then instead of being appointed by the state legislature, they would have to run a physical campaign where the globalists would decide whether you could keep that seat or not. And if you're not going to give them their agenda and support the things that they want you to do, then you're not going to get elected by the people, because they will be supporting and throwing their money at the one that will serve the globalists. To be clear here, that's why they have been buying off these senators, and they've been playing and wreaking havoc with us for years. This is how the UN, because they were globalists. You got to remember that Wilson tried to create a League of Nations, and the Senate was the kibosh. The Senate just wouldn't allow that to happen. And so they said, well, what are we going to do? Well, we got to create this global governing body to basically take over everything so that we could die of obscurity. America and the Constitution would go away so Satan would reign us, control us. And we're close, folks. We're really close. If the state legislatures take back their suffrage in the Senate, That's the whole key. Now, this document doesn't talk about real time, but I do talk about the language of the 14th Amendment. So the next thing is I kind of point out how the language changes. Now, if you think that throwing the language of Section 3 in controlling, you know, the behavior doesn't lend to anything, let me know. So I cover that, the intent of the Senate. So then I go into this little diatribe. The intent of the Senate was to give the state legislature suffrage through a proxy agent, i.e. each senator, to ensure the state legislature's interests were being attended to. The duty of the Senate was involving treaties and the admission of the federal government, something the state legislatures would be more concerned over than the people. And I go into the language of the Article 5, and it's provided that no amendment which shall be made, that, and then going through the 1808 clause of Article 1, Section 9. And so skipping over that, it says that no amendment which shall be made, that no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. The state suffrage was designed, the state suffrage by design was not the suffrage for the people, but suffrage for the state legislatures. Consequently, the 17th Amendment, by only addressing the appointment and the replacement of the senators, did not affect the senators' responsibility to vote according to the direction of the state legislature. In the days of the framers, the flow of information was very limited, which is why these two proxy senators were allowed to the state, were allocated to the state legislature. Keep in mind two very important points. In America, our republicanism is not based on representation of the people. Our representation recognizes the sovereigns due to the process of instituting government, which is only done by we the people, according to the the Declaration of Independence, that all men were created equal. So keep in mind, we migrated completely away from a monarchical theocracy, which was also a magistrate form of government, where the king appointed his magistrates. Thus, in ancient Britain, the sovereignty was shared in a limited form by the monarch to the sheriffs, or whomever he appointed, in Britain's doctrine of lesser magistrates. Even that migrated, by the way. Prior to the Revolution, the monarch created courts and parliaments, which actually is how he migrated that away from the sheriffs and towards the courts and parliament. And here's a breakdown of the sovereignty, and I provide you that the website for that. Clearly, in the creation of our Constitution, we shifted the sovereignty of our government from a single magistrate to a republican form of government with three independent branches. This divided the roles and responsibilities in our government, especially for Congress. When we create representative counties, sheriffs, and so forth, or states and so forth, they get their suffrage in the government above. So these were the things to keep in mind. Let me know if this really helps clarify whether, you know, whether a state legislature can look at this and go, oh my gosh, Article 5 clearly does say that we have a right to that suffrage, and we have real time. I'll get into the real time on Monday, because you need to understand this concept of real time governing. I'm G.R. Mobley, Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an an email. Thank you.